It's like sensing into the collective field of what's wanting to emerge through that value set and sort of the moral standpoint of like, we're here as nature, we are of nature, we seek to, you know, walk lightly upon the earth and to be a species that's in harmony with right relation with the more than human world.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan, and in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Today's guest is Aubrey Yi from Our Beloved Futures. Aubrey is a futurist, a facilitator, a coach, a mother, a woman of many talents. And in this conversation, we talk about her work in the philanthropic and nonprofit space, including what she's learned from facilitating fellowships and weaving networks. We also go into her current projects, including Culture Hack Labs and Project Biome. This conversation was recorded at the Planet Local Summit in Bristol in September 2023. Let's dive in with Aubrey Yi. We are here today with my friend Aubrey Yi. Aubrey is the founder of Our Beloved Futures. Thank you, Aubrey, for doing this.
Of course. And you asked, I said yes. It's that simple. Yeah.
We are here at the Planet Local Summit in Bristol. What brings you here to this place?
Gosh, it's kind of a funny story. I met Natalie Kelly in March in person. We'd been like, you know, conversing around other things at a event for Farmers Footprint, one of Zach Bush's organizations. I was doing a futures activation on glyphosate, ending glyphosate. And she was just so enamored with everything we'd done. And she's like, you've got to meet Helena Norberg Hodge and, you know, all the work she's doing. And so we started talking and Helena's like, would you come to this summit? And I said, of course, absolutely. I've followed your work. I love what you do. All the thinkers involved are people that I admire. And so that started a relationship with Helena and working on sort of how to hold the space of the conference in this vision of like, what is it we're actually trying to create? So we've brought all these people together. She's brought all these people together and they're here to share their ideas, but for what, right? So what I've been holding in the vibration I'm bringing to this is, you know, what is the future we're seeking to create? What is the future we're not wanting to create, but is the default that will happen? So I'll be holding a couple of meditation visualization spaces and then a futures activation in the middle. So that's what brought me here. And then I found out that all my beloved friends like you were coming as well, and which totally made sense because I think we're all on this track of thinking about what it looks like to return, not to something that was before. It's like the idea of the new ancient futures. So they're new, and yet there is an ancient quality to them. And so, of course, all of the beloved friends that I have are here. So it feels really good and I'm excited to be here. And I got to bring my daughter. We'll talk a little bit about motherhood and how that plays into my work. But that was a really beautiful decision because we've been having a great time. And just to expose the next generation to these ideas, I think is really important.
And I understand you visited Stonehenge this morning.
Yes.
How was that?
Again, ancient futures. It was very cool. Mm. You know, she and I talk a lot about like what history is, who makes history, power involved in history making. And so it's so much fun to go to those kind of places with her because we're looking at that and we're like, did they really pull these huge stones with sticks and, you know, rope for hundreds of miles? I don't know. You know, was it aliens? Who knows? You know, like we have these kind of like really robust and interesting conversations around like, what does it mean to make history? What does it mean to tell these stories that inform how we think about who we are as humans? And just to see that site was pretty incredible. And also to learn that it was a private property that in just the it was like 1929 or something, got bought by somebody and then was given to the government. So imagine that in your backyard. It'd be pretty incredible. Yeah. So yeah, it was cool to see.
And I had the privilege of spending a bit of time with your children a couple months ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, to the degree that children are a reflection of their parents, it was just such a special experience because your two kids are really just, very special.
Raising free thinkers for sure.
Yes, yes, indeed. So it seems that you have intentionally oriented yourself towards this conscious visioning of the future and this thread, Our Beloved Futures. Can you share more about, you know, why do you feel like this is the work that you have chosen to do at this time?
Yeah, so the name Our Beloved Futures came through in a bike ride one morning. I bike and swim every day in the summer in the North Shore where we live. And I think it had been coming through for a long time, but it's this idea of, I do believe that as we're moving towards new ways of being on the planet, has to come through the eye of the heart, through our capacity to love and to be in the space of a love vibration, not through the head, because the head is what got us here. And I think holding that space of like, what is it that we're aiming towards? I was sharing with you on the way here, I had this thought come through that it's really us in the Occidental mindset in the West who need the futures the most, because we've lost the ability to be present and to be in presence. And so, you know, there are some, in many indigenous cultures, I think, that are deeply immersed in what it means to be an ancestor and have ancestors and be in that like long arc of time and see time as cyclical, whereas we see time as very linear. And through that, you know, we make a lot of choices that don't think about, you know, the repercussions or take accountability for our actions. And so the futures to me is this like space of thinking of like, who am I becoming? What is my action today building towards, and getting people to think about that more productively through the lens of something that's beloved. Because if you love something and you care about it, you just treat it very differently. And the hour is like the collective nature. You know, we can't be prosperous on our own. It only comes with collective liberation. So it's kind of like holding all those pieces. And I think it's something I've always been interested in since I was a child. I just didn't have a name for it. So I like, you know, stumbled around in a variety of careers before I found future studies and then was like, ah, here we go.
And it sounds different than like a 5 or 10 year strategic plan.
Totally different.
Right? Like coming from a different place. Can you share more about the distinctions and maybe what are the practices to bring that out?
Yeah. I mean, emergence is crucial, I think, to this. I was thinking about this as well as I was coming here, assuming we would talk about this topic, but it's, you know, futures work can be done in a very corporate way. So there's a lot of corporate futurists that'll say like, these are the trends and this is what you can do to make more money. That's not the kind of work I've ever been interested in. And there's a real nature of like emergence to the kind of futures that I'm talking about, where it's paying attention to what's happening. And there's an ethics and a moral like value set baked in that's really around collective good and, like I said, collective liberation. So it's presencing attention, paying attention to what's actually happening, versus like having a specific desire for an outcome. Someone's going to tell you what the future looks like. They're probably trying to sell you something. So it's like sensing into the collective field of what's wanting to emerge through that value set and sort of the moral standpoint of like, we're here as nature, we are of nature. We seek to, you know, walk lightly upon the earth and to be a species that's in harmony with right relation with the more than human world. So that's how I think about it.
Yeah, I love it because it's that balance of recognizing that we have sovereignty and agency and that our actions and our choices matter and do cultivate consequence and influence in this rippling of life, whilst also having that humility and that listening and that quality of recognition that we aren't in control and that we are part of a greater web. And so how do we listen, attune, and find where those emergent threads and those two meet, where we can still exercise our agency and, you know, be explicit about trying to find what makes our heart sing, what is that positive vision, what, because otherwise, you know, we can default to whatever the stories of our culture and mainstream contexts lead us to, which aren't always positive.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying in that there's like an agency that happens in presence. And so it's not an agency that's seeking to control outcome. It's an agency that's always in inquiry and always asking the question and able to sit in the mystery of the question rather than having to have the answer. And I think we've lived into a culture that wants answers. And that's where like the 5-year plan comes in. It's like, here we go. We're going to do all these steps to get to this very specific outcome. And if we don't get there, we've failed. And that's kind of like a linear way of thinking that's created a lot of violence and extraction, destruction. And so when we sit in the question and we allow ourselves to be in the mystery of the not knowing, then we can presence into what actually wants to emerge that's bigger than just our own we can't, like, the things that are possible are so beyond our capacity to hold in one brain. So like when we relax into that, there's so much more that's possible. So I think about it in those terms. It's really, it can be hard for organizations to grapple with because they're so set up. The typical corporate structure can't hold that kind of uncertainty.
Right.
And so I'm really interested in thinking about how do we build systems internally into cultures of, you know, organizations that can handle that and kind of work in that way. Cause I think we can't really make the changes we seek without having that like reckoning first within.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Individually and also in organizations. So.
And I'm also noticing that it's futures, not future.
Always an S.
Always an S. Tell me more about that.
Well, because I mean, if you look at the present, like there's not one present. Like we're sitting here in Bristol. There's a gazillion other moments happening right now that are wide range. Like for some people, they've been living in the apocalypse for generations. I know your background fairly well. We've been living this privileged reality for some generations, you know, maybe some struggle, but not what others have experienced. So there's never just one, right? So it's always an S, it's always plural, and it happens unevenly. So when you think about something like collapse, again, like other people are living in collapse, whereas for some who've been experiencing privilege, collapse feels very scary because they've never experienced it. So always an S, always, you know, infinite number of possibilities. So when you're thinking about the futures, it's contextual. It's like, what do I need to think about in this situation for what I'm trying to create or what discussion I'm trying to have with this particular constellation of humans in this particular time and space? So it's very malleable, and it's a set of processes and questions and sort of sitting with those inquiries.
Yeah. Right. So it sounds like this has been a persistent thread in your work, but can you share more about your background and your journey into this?
Sure. Yeah. I was a reluctant entrepreneur first. I think I've always just been an independent thinker. And so even, you know, coming out of college, it was like the idea of getting a job and going down some sort of well-worn path was really actually terrifying. And so I started working for like startups. It was, you know, early 2000s, got a really great job traveling through Europe as a paid backpacker, like did all these kind of varied things. And then started my own business with my then partner, now husband. And we, again, just wanted to travel and experience the world, and ended up reluctant entrepreneurs with this import-export business. But looking back, what I can see is that that gave me this deeply embedded experience of capitalism on a global scale, of seeing like how flows of capital move, seeing how like extraction happens in like big factories, like going to these big factories in Indonesia. And we would go to every factory we worked with and like try to understand how their workers were treated, and saw some pretty intense things in our early 20s and experienced all of that. And then, you know, built this business and this store and all this stuff. And I realized at one point in the store, I was holding all these events and workshops, and I'm like, oh, I actually don't want to do retail. I want to build community. So I was like, okay, something's not right here, but I've learned a lot. So I turned to my husband, Brady, and I said, you know, I'm done and we need to sell the business. And he's like, you're crazy. And I was like, no, I'm not. He's like, okay, I love you. I'll trust you. And I didn't know what I was going to do then, but I started, you know, I knew I wanted to do something that had more impact, that I'd like absorbed all the learning I could from that experience. And so I started looking at the University of Hawaii where we lived, and stumbled upon this thing called Future Studies, where my mentor had been toiling away for some 40 years and was kind of one of the fathers of the field. It had come out of the Club of Rome and Budapest and these meetings that had happened in Europe in the 70s. And he was like in all of that, and then ended up at the University of Hawaii, just, you know, quietly, very bad at marketing, toiling away at all his futures work. And I had no idea what that field was. But the first time I sat down with him and heard what he had to share, I was like, oh, this fits, because it spoke to my desire for intellectualism and academia, but taking it into the real world and working with communities on the ground, policy and politics, and really understanding how systems work and how to create change. And then it spoke to the poet in me, because it was about vision and visioning and like getting people to see beyond the present and get out of their comfort zones. You know, his name is Jim Dator. He's still alive and he's amazing. Still working away in his like late 80s. But one of his famous quotes is, any useful idea about the future should appear to be ridiculous. And so there was like an absurdity to the work, which I actually now, I can see why that was so resonant for me, because modernity is absurd, you know, and we're living in this time of sort of like the carnival, as our friend Alner says, that it's just like there's so much absurdity happening. And so you have to get out of this tyranny of the present and sort of see beyond. So when I found that and realized that was an actual course of study, I was like, okay, this is for me, and just kept going till I got the PhD and finished, and then went into the world of systems work, and it's sort of been this like circling around different social change technologies, whether it's like systems mapping and systems thinking, narrative-led systems change, futures work, design thinking, all the things.
Yeah. And we've been highlighting a lot of work in the philanthropic space. I understand you also did some work with Omidyar.
Yeah. So I spent 7 years actually helping build a network for social impact, which was again, like something I'd never done before. And they were looking for someone who understood systems mapping and systems change, but Hawaii is a small place. They're like, a futurist will do. So it's close enough. So then I got like kind of immersed in those worlds and saw, you know, the vision there is, you know, if you get emerging leaders across a state, a geographical place like Hawaii who care about the future and something beyond their own like rise in leadership, how might you network them to create new possibilities for change? So then I dove really deep into understanding how networks work and what creates a network for change, for impact, using all these different social technologies. So I did that for 7 years, which was really powerful. I call it my like leadership dojo. Never thought I'd be in leadership development, but got to learn from all these really incredible thinkers and people that were doing sort of frontline work and social impact for systems change. So yeah, that was an incredible experience. And at the end of it, I was able to turn the network back to itself. So as the one that was like the network weaver was my role, I saw that there was a point where it's time for the network to actually lead emergently from within. And so I left that in 2021.
Yeah. I'm curious because we see a lot of different fellowships, incubators, social impact, social purpose network kind of styles of initiatives emerging all over the world. Yeah. And so, you know, having done that experience, and I know you're involved in some of these different flavors now as well, but yeah, curious, any reflections, lessons learned, things that, you know, key leverage points or insights or things, surprises along the way in that space?
Yeah, gosh, a lot. I think networks are really important. I think they've become a little bit like everyone needs to have a network or a fellowship and sort of it, but it's deep work and it requires trust and relationship. So it actually requires an investment in trust and relationship. So you can do a lot of trainings, you can hold people in space together, but if you're not attending to that like deep, almost spiritual level connectivity, the network, I don't believe is really going to do the kind of social impact that we're seeking. So that's one thing I've definitely learned. And I think a lot of people don't have the patience or imagination for that or understanding of how important that like piece of it is.
So being just very professionally transactional or...
Yeah, that can only go so far. And it's not to say that's not useful, but if you're really trying to do deep change work, there's got to be like a relationality present because it starts to build this web of like lines of connection that then allow the work. Because the work is hard. Like systems change work is really hard. It takes a long time. It requires patience. It requires the ability to see change differently because you don't see change on the surface. It's like you've got to see subterranean culture change, like the way people talking changing, like different words being used. Like there's stuff you're looking for that's just really different than I think typical nonprofit work where you can like, you know, have data points and count numbers of people or dollars spent or whatever, which is important. But in this kind of work, it's the type of work that networks are suited for is longer term deep work. So that's one thing I definitely learned. I learned a lot about philanthropy in general and sort of the, you know, there's a massive move towards sole funder-led organizations like the Omidyar Network, where it's, you know, someone who's made a lot of money typically in tech or something like that. So it's different than like the foundation work of the past, which had its own kind of milieu and culture. And there's a lot of language around, you know, Silicon Valley speak of like innovation and, you know, the words that are used even in the world of social impact that I think it's limited, you know, and it sort of misses the point sometimes because we're talking about different things. You don't have a return on investment always in this work and you have to be ready to like be okay with that. So that was something that was interesting to see. And then just understanding, you know, we've been doing a lot of work around this idea of wealth hoarding and like healing wealth and that money has an energetic of scarcity like baked into it. And so there's this, I don't know, it's sort of like a false sense of when you're giving out money that you have to be really strict in like making sure it goes to the right place. And like the flows are just, they're not very generous and they tend to be really restrictive, even in the most forward-thinking organizations. And I think Omidyar is one of the more forward-thinking ones. But still, there's this sense of like, we've got to be careful. And that's where the network helped, because there was a level of trust mm-hmm. with the fellows in the network, so we could give out money a little bit easier. But I just think in general, with the level and pace of change that we're facing, we need to start letting money flow. Like, the money wants to flow. You know, it wants to be liberated. It wants to be re-experienced and put to use. And what's happening in a lot of philanthropy and foundations is it's getting hoarded so that it can make more, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting because it doesn't have to be. You know, there's nothing legally requiring these foundations to grow their balance sheets, you know, instead
it's best practice.
Pushing it out. Yeah. Right. So the change has to be somewhat cultural and social. I'm curious, like, what are you seeing that's working in that field of being able to try to accelerate or liberate the capital more, mm-hmm. And maybe what's not working?
I see when people who have been on the other side of it, like either running a nonprofit or like Indigenous leadership, gets the ability to actually run, like, I'm working with a group in Hawaii called the Ho'iwai Fund. And there's a Native Hawaiian woman who's helping run that, Mahina Paishanduart. And she's just got this beautiful vision for what's possible because she's led a nonprofit. She comes from the Native Hawaiian community. She knows what this money can do. And when I think you get that kind of leadership involved, or people that have a sense of how much the flows, and even just metaphorically, like with that example, we're talking about ho'iwai. Vai is water in Hawaiian, which also means wealth. Vai vai means wealth, and the acknowledgement that water is basic to the source of any wealth, but that the flows, like we use the metaphor of the flows, are so important. And when we start to think about that, then you can see how toxic hoarding becomes. Mm-hmm. You know, I joked that we need to call it affluenza anonymous, because it's like, it's this disease of like, you know, you just got to keep getting richer. And people don't mean to hoard and don't think of it that way. Mm-hmm. But if we could reimagine that narrative of like, the flow becomes part of the work, like creating more and more flow rather than trying to make more in the back room, you know, there's something around that, like, that I think is really important.
And I think in the absence of as captivating of singular metrics that are so easy to kind of go, okay, well, here's the endowment size, and now we're growing it to this size. And like, it's just so simple and seductive, it seems, to a lot of the human mind.
Yeah.
And in the absence of that similar set of conditions for value creation, which is so much more difficult to measure and amorphous and pluralistic and multifaceted, that it's all the more important that we do that field building and that network building, because it's like, when there's more of a reinforced set of constructs from your peers or from people you love and respect, and, you know, there's a lot of people that then are like, okay, great, like, this is deserving of resources.
Yeah.
You know, this is good work and this is creating value and it's affirmed by the social context, then I think it's much easier to get to yes.
Totally.
You know, and we need those types of like, yeah, cohesive fields and groups and networks that transcend any single organization or any single sector. Just to like all be locked arms, like on the journey together, go, okay, great. Like, here's where there's capital. Great. Let's move it into this place.
Yes. And
yeah. I'm curious, any other reflections about how this marriage between liberating capital and field building or network building, you know, works in tandem?
I think it plays back into like the narrative work too. And there's like something I'm thinking about around responsibility, that there's a misunderstood sense of responsibility in philanthropy, that the responsibility should be more placed on actually flowing the money out, versus being responsible means I'm making a solid return and just giving out the money in bits. You know, it's like, that should be, if we could shift the culture around that, and like you're saying, the field building, where it becomes normalized to say, spend down a foundation, like also normalizing the fact that it doesn't have to live forever. We have this notion that foundations live for hundreds of years and it becomes a legacy project. And it's like, that doesn't have to be. It could be, the faster you spend it, that's how you gain your sense of, you know, success in that field. If you can spend it faster, you know, if we were able to shift those narratives, I think that would be really powerful.
Yeah. And so that looks like celebrating those examples where there is that more accelerated spend down, and also finding ways that people can feel less of that fear of like, well, wait, does that mean I don't longer have a job or I no longer have my social standing? You know,
there's an abundance mindset in all of this that sees, and I think when we think of flows, it's like flows in our life and our livelihood. And circling back to the City of the Planet Local Summit and what excited me about this work and the thinkers that are here this weekend is I think there's a deep acknowledgement that when you're in right relations in a society that sees each other as whole humans, there's a fluidity to that that allows you to feel the abundance that is available. You know, I was sharing to you before we started about being at Stonehenge and seeing these flowers. And it's like the abundance of earth that makes these flowers every day that are so incredibly beautiful just for free. Like when we start to see each other and see our environment and see what's, and I think there's something about that that the local allows for that the global sort of erases, we can relax into that abundance and know like there's always going to be enough if we're in right relation with each other and with the planet. And then I can be more fluid. I don't have to always be in this same role. I don't have to feel the fear of losing something. Each door closing becomes another door opening. You know, there's this less of a sense of grasping to a false sense of certainty that never actually existed anyway, you know? So.
Yeah. Okay, so you were a reluctant entrepreneur. You did your studies, future studies, and spent 7 years, you know, in this field with Omidyar. And you mentioned, you know, corporations aren't necessarily configured well for doing that type of future visioning. So curious how this has all led to the work you're doing today.
Yeah, I think it's not so much that they can future vision, but holding the space of emergence, I think, is the hard part for a lot of organizations because it's uncertain. Mm-hmm. You know, they want a sense of like, and they have to report to shareholders. Like there's a whole system baked in of needing to create certainty or a sense of certainty and security that is, I think, being challenged by what's required. So now I work with Culture Hack Labs. Currently, two major projects are Culture Hack Labs and the Biome, Project Biome, which are both about rethinking the internal organizational culture while doing change work out in the world. But to me, what excited me and drew me to both of those projects was that both organizations are curious about and willing to do the work of looking in to the organization itself. And it's like, how are we running? Which then allows us to operate in the world differently. And I think that's what I'm interested in understanding more about.
Because why is that so important?
It feels like it's the fractal nature of reality to me, that like if we can get that piece right of like the internal operating system of the organizations, then we can actually do the work in the world we're seeking to make. I think I'd gotten used to hearing people say the words and really have like desire to make the sort of transformative change they were talking about, but then it's just not happening. And it was starting to become clear to me that a lot of that is because of the internal state of the organization. And if you're not operating from a place, you know, you're saying you want to do something in the world, but you're still operating from a place of, you know, paternalism or colonialism or all the different isms that are at work in our bodies and in our systems.
So doing that prefigurative work by ensuring that the culture of the team and the organization is matching the kind of impact or influence that they want to have out in the world. And because it's all just fractals and mirrors, and if we kind of run our organizations one way, but expect the future and everything externally to go another way, it's a fool's errand.
Totally. And I think if we can get it right, and I actually haven't experienced it yet, like fully there. So that's why I think it's exciting, because it feels like it's a work in progress. But those two groups that I'm working with feel like they're open enough and willing enough and have done enough of their, each individual in the organization has done enough internal work to show up in a way that it's possible. But I think if we can reach that, and maybe you'll find an organization that's doing this really well, I'd love to experience that. But I think we can then get to that fractal nature of like one, you know, input of work has like 100 impact in the world, you know, and that's what we're looking for right now, because I don't think the way that we're working is exhausting us, especially people in the social impact sector. Activists are freaking exhausted, and like it makes sense. They've been fighting, you know, this uphill battle, and it's like, that's not how it's going to work. And so we're in this other moment, this liminal space of transition where different kinds of work is needed that allows for rest, that allows for a whole person to be present, that allows for family, that allows for, you know, all the things. And so that's kind of what I'm curious about. You know, as much as the work itself is like, how do we start to show up differently as people?
Right.
Yeah.
So can you share more about what is Culture Hack Labs?
Oh boy, lots of things. Narrative-led systems change. And it's so, I'll apologize in advance for jargon. I struggle with that.
You're doing great.
Okay, good. Sometimes I'm like, do people know the words that I'm sharing? So narrative-led systems change is really what's at the heart of that project. It came out of the rules, which was, you know, started by Alnor and a group of others. And it understands that the whole world is made of stories, you know, that narratives craft our reality, that we are sitting here in these chairs with this cup of coffee because someone at some point decided coffee should be in a cup and people should sit in chairs with microphones to share information. Like, all of this is a story. Mm. And so culture becomes a shared agreement of stories. And what does it look like to shift that? And so if you think about hacking and like the idea of like getting into computer code and like rewriting the code, what does it look like to rewrite the code of culture? And so, you know, they've developed some incredible methodologies that aim to do that. It's, you know, it's an experiment that's a grand experiment that's really beautiful to be involved in because the people who show up for that experiment are big-hearted, curious, you know, passionate, beautiful humans. And so I feel very like privileged to be part of that work. But it really is seeking to understand that question of like, how do we get to the code of culture and rewrite it in service to life? If we see the systems that we're enmeshed in as toxic, extractive, destructive, you know, destroying the world, which I believe is true, how do we rewrite culture to be centropic, something that actually builds life, that works with life, that creates life rather than destroys it, is at the heart of that project. And so it spawned a bunch of different, you know, sub-projects within that, but that's the core.
Right. And as I've experienced it, it is very much like a network. You know, you have linguists and activists and computer
very
programmers.
Very decentralized, which can be frustrating at times, but I love it. Some people get really frustrated. They're like, there's no structure. I'm like, I know, isn't it great? It's
like, and they run kind of different interventions or these hacks of like going after different topics. Like I know there was one around land ownership recently and kind of what is the story of land ownership and how do we, you know, kind of stretch our imaginations and think differently.
Because that's a story that we've told, that like land should be privatized, that you should have private property. And we're all enmeshed in that story with, you know, very fear-based, very scarcity-based, deeply embedded in our culture and is spread around the world. And like, what would it look like to rewrite that? Mm. You know, that's a big one.
What are some of the other interventions that Culture Hack Labs has been running?
So one we're working on right now is around workers' rights. So understanding like the future of work, which is a huge question because it's like work has come to define who we are. And yet work means so many different things to so many different people and where you are situated in the world and, you know, the type of family you're born into and your, you know, capacity for what sorts of work you can get determines your life. Like, I mean, it's just, it's big. So that's another big one that we're diving into right now. And the territories of transition work around land defense and the land narrative. And then we had a fellowship where we actually brought together different activists in different, you know, like climate justice was one area, food sovereignty is another area. So all things around, you know, building more thriving futures where there's like a justice component clearly baked into all of that, you know, like collective liberation. The liberation of one means liberation of all. You know, it's a very kind of expansive vision for what it looks like to live on the planet differently.
Mm. Yeah. And that fellowship you mentioned, that's the Rhizome Fellowship?
The Rhizome Fellowship, yeah.
I know you played an integral role in that. Yeah. Can you share more?
Yeah, that was beautiful. So I took, you know, some of what I had experienced in the Omidyar Fellows Network and building that, brought it to a virtual network, which is very different, you know, having to do things virtually. Mm. And any funders out there, we'd love funding for cohort two, because that's part of it is, you know, this work is hard for people to understand, especially narrative work, because again, it's more intangible, but it's so deep and so important. And so that's why I'm so passionate about it. So it was virtual, but, you know, people were pretty much around the world, not much in Asia, just time zones made it almost impossible, but Central South America, Africa, the US, all passionate activists wanting to learn this methodology and to put it into action. So we took them through, you know, very rigorous methodology training and then actually had them practice hacks together and now building a larger network. So future cohorts of fellows and that sort of thing. So that's more of an emergent network where it's, you know, people will be doing different work based on what they're passionate about. But the vision is that you could all be steeped in this methodology, share this language around narratives, and say you're, you know, embarking on a hack, reach out to a collective of people who understand this work and say, hey, I need XYZ, or I'm trying to find information around this, or I need someone who does filmmaking or whatever it might be, but to expand the capacity for people trying to do narrative-led systems change.
Mm. Yeah. I'm curious what you experienced in the format. You said doing it virtually is different and obviously, you know, being in this type of work for some time, like what are the advantages and disadvantages you see? And now that you're also thinking about the future of work and how this interplays with, you know, physical presence versus digital.
And Planet Local, which is about like localizing and bringing things back into contact. Mm. I think there's something, I mean, it's so beautiful that we can reach around the globe and have contact. I think that that's definitely something that should not be lost. Mm-hmm. And it can't be everything. You know, back to this idea of networks work at the speed of trust. And I think you can build so much trust virtually, but there's something that happens in the physical space. We're biological beings, like being in physical contact, being able to give a hug, being able to look in someone's eyes, being able to exchange so much more on the subtle levels than just words. And your presence in a, you know, circle of squares, there's something intangible to that, that I think just it like lightning speeds things up. Mm-hmm. So it's possible virtually, and there's an advantage to being able to reach around the globe. But when you can combine the two, I think that's where like the magic can really start to happen. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, the realities of time and space and people being in all these different countries. And so, you know, you do what you can with what you have, but I think it's that speed of trust piece. It just, you can't beat. In person. Yeah.
Great. Okay. And then you mentioned another project that you are plugging in with.
Yeah. Project Biome. Yeah.
Not to be confused with Biome Trust.
Which is so amazing.
An organization I'm affiliated with it. But yeah.
It's an idea whose time has come. And this idea of the human biome. And, you know, it's not that long that we now sort of generally agree that there's a thing called the human biome and it's important and we should care for it. And it's our gut and all these things, which is amazing because like indigenous peoples have known for millennia or even longer that like we think in multiple ways, not just through our brain, also through our heart, also through our gut, also through our dreams, et cetera.
One thing I love about that word biome, sorry to interrupt you, is just like, it doesn't have a common universal definition, but when we've traced it, it's, you know, community of life is one of the like unifying agreed upon definitions, because it is such a fractal. Like there's a community of life in my gut that is having a profound impact on my health, my mental well-being, and everything else. There's life in the soil. There's life in my bioregion. There's life at a planetary scale. And it seems that the work of our time needs to operate with an understanding of these different fractals and these different layers, but also that community provocation.
Yeah. You know? We're always a multitude of beings. The myth of separation, you know, it's like that whole idea of individuality is total myth. Yeah. So the biome, that like idea of the biome, I think is a one that whose time has come. And so Project Biome is taking that idea of, you know, my friend, Dr. Zach Bush, who's been a friend for many years, asked me to come and help get this project started. And again, it's this idea of like bringing into the project what we're calling living systems methodologies, but ways to help the organization itself become more like an organism so that it operates in that living systems way, you know, using biomimicry and other ways of thinking about how people interact and how, you know, one of our board members was just saying like, what can we learn from how floods work and how fires work and how do we bring those kinds of like natural processes into organizations in ways that are positive and needed. But it's so Project Biome, you know, in the world is looking to unlock the powers of regeneration. Mm. So really working with Earth and human systems to unlock these latent powers of regeneration that do things like make beautiful flowers for free every morning or fruit off a tree and are just have been blocked, you know, and we're starting in Southern Africa and you know, it's stuff like taking down fences in areas where like wildlife corridors have been locked up and looking at the cradle of humanity and thinking about how to take that as a project and really reinvigorate that whole region with an eye towards reinvigorating the water systems all the way up the spine of Africa. Mm. So small vision, you know, to make the Sahara green again, actually, because there's these like big, like geologic cycles where the Sahara was once green, it wasn't a desert, and it's coming back around to that potentiality. And so how might we unlock the systems that want to make that happen? Mm-hmm. So it's not us as humans doing it, but just right. working with nature and then creating an organization that works more like an organism. Mm-hmm. So we're really at the outset of that. And I don't have the answers yet, but I'm deeply in the inquiry of like, what does that look like? How does that show up in a team meeting? Mm-hmm. You know, when you like with people on a Zoom screen, because mm-hmm. again, it's a multi, you know, global team. From South Africa to Hawaii is about as hard as you can get in terms of time zones, right. but we're making it work. Right. But, you know, how does that actually show up in things like team meetings or, you know, marketing plans or websites or all these kind of very like logistical, operational pieces? Mm-hmm. But I do think that's the future of where we're going with how we need to operate, you know, in the work we're trying to do to actually create the worlds that we're seeking to create. Break through the systems that are holding us back.
Yeah. Yeah. It resonates so deeply for me. And probably not a coincidence. We've been referring to ourselves as a philanthropic organism.
Nice.
I think partly influenced by our dear beloved Yael Marantz,
yes,
who helped us bring that terminology in.
And
yeah, this recognition that these organizations are living systems and beings and communities of life. And so how do we adopt those types of practices consciously and intentionally? And I think it's also just very pragmatic for 2023, you know, in terms of being adaptable and flexible to a changing world that surrounds us, where there's so much dynamism and so much unpredictability. And so the qualities of being able to be in relationship with the external world and being able to flow, depending on the contexts and the webs that we're weaving, I think is just like a very wise way to operate these teams.
And yeah, there's like a fragility to the old way, you know, that I think worked before and gave a sense of security and safety that now actually is like a liability and makes organizations fragile if they can't start to adopt this new kind of more porous way of thinking about themselves, decentralized. Yeah, and just words in general and like taking from the natural world or not taking, but working with the natural world and all her gifts and words and ways of being and bringing that into these very human systems. I have a friend in Hawaii, Kamuela Inos, a brilliant thinker, Native Hawaiian man, and he had this thing called triple pico analysis for his business. Pico is your belly button. It's like considered the center of everything in Hawaiian cosmology. And he's like, when you're thinking about that, for in their example, they had a farm. I might have shared this story with you before, but they had a farm and they have interns, Ma'o Farms. The interns come from the Waianae Coast. It's a very, you know, high rates of poverty and crime and all the things. And they bring these kids in and they're like, we're not just looking at how much food do we sell. We're looking, what are the GPA of the kids that have come in? Is there, is their schoolwork improving? Is their health improving? So actually measuring like, because they're eating the food that they're selling, that's all, you know, fresh veggies and produce from this organic farm. So are they getting healthier? And it's like these multiple levels of analysis that we bring into these otherwise, you know, very kind of linear organizations like a business or philanthropy or whatever it is, and start to like expand the view of what we call success to be holistic of the biome, of the human, of biology, of our relationship to earth. You know, all of that becomes really exciting and important and actually something different.
Yeah. And I love the emergent approach and getting back to that core insight that corporations can't hold that emergence as effectively. And so how do you see projects like Culture Hack Labs or Project Biome, you know, serving in this liminal transition moment that we're in?
We were talking about earlier cultures of transition, and I'm liking that like frame of thinking about like, what is it, you know, back to the idea of creating culture, building culture from story, from shared myth and agreement, and what does it look like to build that in times of transition? And it's, there's something around like the not just embracing messiness, but like actually loving messiness and loving uncertainty and like being excited by those things rather than afraid of them, that I think becomes really central to where like mistakes become exciting, like failures become like actually something to celebrate, because then it's like another learning point. So like shifting the cultures within to actually see these things as like, as we're learning our way towards something new. And I've found that both of those organizations are willing to do that. And the other thing that is really kind of interesting to me and feels really foundational is a belief in whatever you want to call spirit, source, creator, whatever your words are, something bigger than us, earth, whatever, but like being led by that. being led by plant intelligence, being led by a source or a creator, or something that's giving guidance, paying attention to signs beyond the rational mind, and actually allowing that to be discussed openly in the organization. Mm. Like that to me is like radical and amazing and beautiful. And I think so necessary as we transition to whatever's coming next, right, where we get out of this trap of rationality and, you know, sort of scientific ways of thinking in the Western format that feels really, really important.
Well, you have such a beautifully articulate way of sharing these messages. And I sat in circle with you last year at the Transition Resource Circle.
That was awesome.
Kind of philanthropic giving circle gathering of radical funders imagining new futures together. Mm-hmm. And one thing that struck me about being in your presence for those days was most of us were groggy in the morning and rubbing our eyes and sitting down in circle after 10, 12 hour days. And you're like, oh, well, I woke up, you know, a couple hours ago and I just, this poem came to me or this, were sharing your writings and every day you were writing like pieces of just masterful poetry and art.
They flow through. It's not mine. It comes from somewhere back to source, but yeah.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you could share more about that and also how that is expressing itself with your Our Beloved Futures podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, I think I've always been a poet since I can remember being a child and sitting in like my closet and writing sad poetry and crying, having all these emotions. Like just have always been drawn to poetry. I ended up being an English major that studied poetry, all of that. I just have a poetic way of thinking and like mythopoetic for sure. And mornings have become like really sacred to me. So hence, you know, get up at 5 and be like sitting in contemplation. It's taken various forms, like whether it's breath work or actually recently started praying the rosary in like a altered format that's more earth-based, but like a meditative sort of practice. And then that leads to these downloads that just come through that are, you know, a mash of all the things I've experienced in source presenting something. Like I said, I'm driving here. I'm like trying to write notes because these things were coming through. I'm like, I got to get this down. There's this beautiful story of a poet talking about the poem coming on the wind and her having to catch it. And I feel like that's what happens for me. Like things come and I catch them. And so Our Beloved Futures is really like trying to catch that poem on the wind and feeling really blessed to have been given the privilege to meet so many incredible people. Like when I really started to reflect on it not that long ago, I was like, God, I have had this incredible opportunity to meet people like you and Yael and people we've talked about in this conversation and so many others around the world. And they're all doing such incredible work. And I just want to share it, you know, in a very like conversational format, but just help people to see like there is possibility and hope and reignite imagination. Because I think imagination is the most potent force available to humanity. We don't realize how powerful it is. Again, back to that idea of like myth and story, it's like we're always dreaming the world into existence. So if we become conscious dreamers, so it's aimed towards that, like becoming collectively conscious dreamers of new realities, and that everyone's invited to the party. Like it's not held in anyone's hands or brains or hearts. It's we're all welcome, and all of our life force and life story is needed. So it's from that place, you know. It's still pretty infant. I know it's very low tech, which has been great. Another thing, I was able to give myself permission to just be low tech and use my laptop and my headset and just go with that, and allow the stories to emerge. But the vision is towards a much bigger network building project that really is around creating spaces for this radical collaboration, radical imagining, dreaming new worlds into being, building the cultures of transition and making it joyful. You know, it doesn't have to feel heavy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a very beautiful production. Definitely, we'll put links in the show notes. And your first episode was with our beloved Yael Marantz.
Yes, had to be.
So highly recommend folks check that one out.
Absolutely.
I have one more question or line of questions for you, which is what are your remarkable children teaching you?
Oh my gosh, so much. They're so amazing. So my son, Tao, is 9. He'll be 10 in a few months. My daughter, Samira, is 11, almost 12. And it's hard for me to believe they're already that old. Like sometimes I'm like, oh my gosh, they've gotten so big. We've been on a journey of de-schooling, unschooling, and I get like more radicalized in it every semester, I feel like. I'm like, this curriculum thing, it's too oppressive. And just realizing that like as human beings, we are natural learners. And when given an environment to be in where we're supported and held in our learning, we don't need any outside influence other than the world and just like access to people and access to information. And we swim in information right now. Mm-hmm. So they're teaching me about that right now, really just relaxing out of this need for a path. You know, again, back to the uncertainty in these times of transition. We don't know. Like people are like, are your kids going to go to college? I'm like, I don't know. Maybe right. not. Like I'm not going to prescribe either way. Mm-hmm. So they're teaching me a lot about letting them be who they are mm-hmm. and seeing the world through their eyes. And that's just been a really profound journey to be able to steward that.
And how do you find that confidence to do things differently?
It's taken time. It's like an internal battle. I had to unlearn a lot within myself. Mm. There was lots of nights where I'd wake up like, oh my God, am I doing the wrong thing?
Right.
Or, you know, you go on social media and you see like first day of school and all the pictures and it just like your gut is like, oh my God, have I made the wrong decision?
So much pressure. So much pressure. Like being a good mother.
Totally. Yeah. But I just look at the evidence in front of me and I watch them hold conversations with adults and have opinions. That I'm like, wow, that was a really good opinion. Like, right. or tell me stuff back where I'm like, wow, where did you get that idea? Or, you know, kind of check me in like the way I'm parenting them very like eloquently. And I'm like, okay, they're doing good.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like the evidence is there in front of me. If I'm present with them and not in my fear space of like what's supposed to be in all the programming I've been downloaded, that I can actually be in that right relation. And it's again, another practice of like right relation and presence in the present. Yeah. So,
well, I'll never forget that conversation I had over dinner with Tao about crypto, Web3,
yes,
currencies.
Totally.
He understood that stuff more than 99.9% totally. Of us. And it was like, whoa.
He's always been interested in money and financial flows, like since he was like 4. It's so interesting. And when you see like each child comes, I think, with some thread of curiosity that is wanting to make manifest in the world. And you just got to make way for it. So for him, it's always been around financial flow. And I'm like, where did he get that? It's not for me. Like, I didn't think I'd have a capitalist son, but maybe he'll be, you know, he definitely wants to help the world too. So I'm hopeful, but it's like, and then Samira is an artist, you know, and just that's not her thing at all, but she's got a whole different way of flowing with the world. And so they're fun.
Yeah.
They're
great. Well, you're very lucky. Any final reflections or messages you'd like to share?
No, just grateful to the work you're doing, the space you're holding. I think the vision that you hold and that you're able to articulate and the like web weaving capacity that you have in your world as a weaver with just such heart and presence. I want to honor that. And I'm deeply excited to see what emerges from this project and all the people involved. And I have such hope when you're holding the mantle of the future of what we call capitalism. But I think there is, you know, at the end of the day, money is energy and its flows we've been talking about. And I think you see that and you're able to articulate a new vision. So I'm just really grateful you're doing that work. It's big work. Yeah. Thank you.
Be on the journey with you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Aubrey.
You bet. Thanks, man.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Aubrey Yee. To learn more about her work and to listen to her podcast, go to ourbelovedfutures.com. You might also be interested in checking out Culture Hack Labs at culturehack.io. Links are in the show notes. For more great conversations like this one, go to maearth.com. Please like, share, subscribe, spread the word. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you on the next one.